From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Lord David Owen, who spent 3 years trying to negotiate a peace settlement between the warring parties in the former Yugoslavia. We'll talk about what it was like to sit at the negotiating table with men who were behind ethnic cleansing and the mass slaughter of civilians. We'll discuss some of the absurdities and contradictions of the war and get his reaction to the peace plan that was agreed to in Dayton, brokered by Americans after Lord Owen had given up. Also, Milo Miles reviews a new recording by Mo Boma. While some might call it New Age, Milo prefers the term meditative. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. The government says the consumer inflation rate in 1995 was the lowest it has been in nearly a decade. Prices increased just 2.5%. It was the fourth year in a row of moderate inflation. In December, prices edged up only 0.2%. Analyst Tim Rogers says last month's numbers show that inflation remains in check.
The December numbers were really broad-based and modest in size. We didn't see any big gains except for a 1.2% jump in energy prices. This is consistent with what we've been seeing over the last few quarters, very tame inflation.
The new report on inflation comes a day after the Federal Reserve lowered short-term interest rates. Some analysts say the lack of inflationary pressure gives the Fed room for further interest rate cuts to boost the economy. In Southern California, a freight train carrying hazardous chemicals derailed early this morning and burst into flames. At least 4 people were injured and 2 are missing. NPR's Ina Jaffe reports.
2 members of the train's 3-man crew are missing, but one was able to crawl to safety after most of the train's 49 cars overturned. The other 3 injured were truck drivers passing by at the time of the accident. They complained of nausea and dizziness. Officials say the train was carrying several different hazardous chemicals, including butyl acrylate, which is used for making paints and adhesives and which is known to irritate the eyes, nose, and throat. As the train burned, a toxic cloud enveloped the area, and nearby homes and businesses were evacuated. Firefighters were also forced to stay at least 0.5 mile away from the wreck because of the fumes. Roads in the area have been closed, including a 20-mile portion of Interstate 15, the main highway between Los Angeles and Las Vegas. I'm Ina Jaffe in Los Angeles.
2 U.S. soldiers were injured in Bosnia today when one of them stepped on a landmine. They were among peacekeeping troops inspecting a mine field about 10 miles from the U.S. headquarters in Tuzla. President Clinton welcomed French President Jacques Chirac to the White House this morning. Mr. Clinton praised France for its help with peacekeeping efforts in Bosnia.
Together, we are helping Bosnia find its way from war and devastation to peace and reconstruction. I salute France, its humanitarian organizations, and especially its soldiers for the tremendous sacrifices they have made to help the Bosnian people. The United States is proud to work with you to help the peace take hold and endure.
Chirac spoke to a joint meeting of Congress, but dozens of Democratic lawmakers boycotted the speech to protest France's recent series of nuclear weapons tests in the South Pacific. Chirac will attend a state dinner at the White House this evening. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down nearly 17 points at 5,378 in heavy trading. This is NPR News. The bitter cold weather freezing much of the nation's midsection is being blamed for several deaths, and no relief is expected through the weekend. Sub-zero temperatures were reported this morning throughout Minnesota. Already crowded shelters for the homeless in Kansas City have been jam-packed each night this week. More than 1 million Russian and Ukrainian coal miners have gone on strike. Coal mining is still a state-owned industry in both countries. One Russian lawmaker said the strike could lead to an economic emergency in the country unless it's settled quickly. A federal appeals court in San Francisco has overturned a ruling by California's Public Utilities Commission, which protected unlisted telephone numbers from being disclosed by new caller identification technology. Jason Bobien, a member station KQED in San Francisco, reports.
Caller ID gives a phone customer access to the phone number of who is calling them. California is scheduled to implement caller ID on June 1st, but the California Public Utilities Commission had blocked the technology from applying to unlisted telephone numbers. Now the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals has ruled that unlisted numbers also will be disclosed unless the caller dials a special code before placing the call. The State Public Utilities Commission decried the ruling, saying it violates the right to privacy of individuals who have specifically asked that their phone numbers be kept private. Pacific Bell officials say the ruling will affect the almost 4 million Californians with unlisted residential phone numbers. For National Public Radio, I'm Jason Beaubien in San Francisco.
The judge in the trial of Yigal Amir, the confessed assassin of Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin, has ordered a psychiatric evaluation of Amir. Judge Edmund Levy's announcement surprised lawyers for both sides. Prosecutors objected, but Levy said he wants to be sure Amir gets a fair trial. The defense has never argued that Amir was insane. Two defense attorneys quit this week over Amir's insistence on turning the trial into a political platform. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Lord David Owen, spent 3 years trying to negotiate a peace agreement between the warring parties in the former Yugoslavia. In 1992, he was appointed by the European Community as a chairman of the International Conference on the former Yugoslavia. Owen and his co-chair, Cyrus Vance, submitted the Vance-Owen peace plan, which was never adopted. Lord Owen stepped down from his position last summer. Shortly after, a peace plan brokered by Americans was agreed to in Dayton. American troops are now in Bosnia helping to enforce that agreement. Lord Owen has written a new memoir about his peace efforts called Balkan Odyssey. Lord Owen is the former Foreign Secretary of England and founder of the Social Democratic Party. As he tried to reach an agreement with the presidents of Bosnia, Serbia, Croatia, and the leader of the Bosnian Serbs, ethnic cleansing and mass slaughter continued in Bosnia. You know what I think the most difficult thing to understand is the thing that we probably most really want to know about. What was it like to sit at a negotiating table with men who were masterminding ethnic cleansing and the mass slaughter of civilians?
Extremely unpleasant. You have to do it. In my case, there was a particular difficulty because sitting opposite me on the table was Dr. Karadzic, who was a doctor of medicine. And I found it very hard to accept that this character could be sitting there as a doctor and masterminding an ethnic cleansing campaign.
He was the leader of the Bosnian Serbs.
He was the leader of the Bosnian Serbs, so-called president of Republika Srpska, who was a psychiatrist. I think he started off the war a better man than he ended it, to be honest. I think there was a coarsening of him and his personality during the war. And I'm afraid war often does that. And one kept on trying to guard against being coarsened or to sort of dulled by these horrors that were happening around one. And I wanted to feel the pain of it, to be honest. My reaction was, this war must be brought to an end, a sense of urgency. And Mr. Vance and I both felt that. We once went down to Banja Luka at the request of the UN High Commissioner for Refugees and the International Red Cross because of the ethnic cleansing that was going on. I think it was in late September 1992. And I've never before encountered a place where I felt evil in the air. You felt you could hold it, cut it. The air was suffused with horror. And after that, we worked night and day, 7 days a week, endless pursuit. You just look at the front of the book, it chronicles all the meetings that we held, and we were literally driving forward to get a peace as quickly as we could. Came back to the capitals of the world, the United Nations Security Council, and we found none of the same urgency, a lot of moralizing, but none of the same urgency. It was very disappointing.
What is the etiquette when you're sitting around the negotiating table and you know that ethnic cleansing is going on? Is it something that you address or that you politely don't address at the table?
Oh, no, we addressed it every single time we met them. We were demanding prisoners to be returned. We were demanding the actual practice of ethnic cleansing should stop, that the war should cease.
Did anybody at the table admit that it was going on?
Well, one of the ways in which these things are handled in the Balkans is that people lie. I say in my book that I've never before in 20, 30 years of public life been so consistently lied to. Now, it's not just my experience. Lord Carrington has exactly the same. And practically everybody who's had anything to do with it finds that there is no respect for the truth. Look at the ceasefires. Look at the number of ceasefires that used to be signed. In fact, Mr. Vance and I decided to give up having ceasefires when we started because prior to that, there'd been any number of ceasefires. They were scattered around like confetti. Sign up to anything. Absolutely. And the sick joke of the time was, you know, when will the first shell fall? When the ink's still wet.
What's an example of one of the most awful lies that you were told?
Well, I mean, I knew at times that massacres had taken place and were probably even taking place as we spoke, and they denied absolutely flatly that anything was being done. I made representations against some, you know, evil practices, either if I wasn't there with them directly on the phone, but very frequently directly. It was this constant dissembling, this constant thing. And I'm afraid all the leaders at various times were, with a few exceptions, responsible for this. Yep. I don't know why it comes, whether it's a mixture of... Yugoslavia, in a way, was built on a lie, and particularly after the 1945 war. Tito told his people that this had been a victory of the partisans against the invading German and Italian forces. Whereas, in fact, there'd been a savage civil war running from 1940 onwards. There'd been a genocide of the Serbs by the Croats, and more people had lost their lives as a result of inter-Yugoslav fighting than ever as a result of German or Italian bullets.
It's almost, difficult to reconcile when you look at Milosevic, you know, well-dressed man and everything, to reconcile the way he looks on TV, which is where I've seen him, and in photographs, with the actions that he is responsible for.
Well, it's very hard to nail down exactly what he is responsible for. He's certainly responsible for getting a Serbian nationalism of a crude and vulgar and dangerous kind to emerge in the late 80s and carry it through into the start of the war. This was matched in great part by what was happening by President Tudjman. All of these people seem to want to push ahead regardless of the cost to their own people. And there was sometimes, I describe in the book, you often thought that the only people who were really listening for the urgency for peace were the women interpreters, who sometimes would absolutely beg us to go on negotiating. So 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock in the morning, we really found we just simply couldn't make any further progress. And we were about to say end. And they could sense it because they knew what we were saying to ourselves. And they would say, oh, go on, try and get a settlement. Try and go on that things. And you could sense that mothers worried about their children and this thing. You sometimes felt the politicians were completely detached from the casualties that their actions were helping to invoke.
Don't you think they'd have to be in order to allow the war to continue?
I mean, well, I think you have to harden your heart in war. Everybody does, you know. I think it's a mythical story, but it is said of Churchill, who was in possession of Enigma intelligence of German intentions to bomb Coventry, that he let the bombing go ahead. I think this is actually not quite true, but there must have been occasions when, for fear of alerting the Germans to the fact that we had tapped into their ciphers and we knew what they were doing, we had to let certain events happen. So part of fighting a war and winning a war, calling for sacrifices from your people, is perfectly legitimate. And President Šeparović did so, and I understand why he did. I have the greatest sympathy for him. He was the only leader who was not a communist and had gone to jail for his views. But
he's the head of the Bosnian Muslim government.
He's the head of the Bosnian Muslim government, and he did try, and his other colleagues tried to get a multi-ethnic Bosnia. But, you know, I'm afraid sins and wickedness was done on all sides, but that is not to say that there is an equivalence of guilt. They're not all the same. The worst things were done by the Bosnian Serbs and then the Bosnian Croats, and much lower down the list of horrors were the Bosnian Muslims. But that isn't to say that all Serbs are evil people. Far from it. They are actually a great nation, and we have got to restore the self-confidence of Serbs. But they must face up to the fact that grievous things were done, and that is why I think the War Crimes Tribunal is a necessary element in catharsis and in reconciliation and in bringing about a lasting peace, because this time it must not be swept under the carpet. This time it must be faced.
I'd like you to share your personal impressions, if you would, of some of the leaders in the former Yugoslavia. Maybe we could start with Milosevic, the president of Serbia.
He's a pragmatist. I don't think he's either a racist or particularly a nationalist. He used nationalism. He rode on the tiger of nationalism. Once he was on it, he found it difficult to get off. But in credit to him, he did start to get off. We were very slow to realize that he was getting off. And for too long, we had to divide the Serbs, not because he would want to divide the Serbs, but the Bosnian Serbs were totally intractable. They wanted a peace settlement. They wanted a piece of territory where there were no Croats and Muslims. Milosevic was much more practical. He didn't mind. After all, the Serbs have Muslims in Belgrade. There was never the same sense of ethnic purity coming from Belgrade that there was coming from the Bosnian Serbs. But he was a man who was interested in power, ruthless, used people, dumped people, quite engaging. And when you began to negotiate with him and he began to trust you, you could actually begin to trust his own word, a pragmatist.
Was he a man who you thought of as being comfortable watching thousands of people die so that he could keep or expand his power?
I think he probably, as the war went on, was facing the horror that this was happening to his own Serb nation. And he's not an emotional man. You never saw much signs of emotion. But, I mean, the fact of the matter is, we both negotiated with Milosevic acceptance of the Vanshoven peace plan in April, when we knew the Bosnian Serbs were never going to accept it, and the Croatian Serbs wouldn't have accepted a ceasefire either without Milosevic pushing them. Now, the world decided that Milosevic was the biggest evil and seemed to have no recognition that people can change. A negotiator must take advantage of any changes. That's not to say he was a good man, but he was a person who, to use Mrs. Thatcher's word once of Gorbachev, you could do business with.
What about Radovan Karadzic, the leader of the Bosnian Serbs?
Well, I've already said I found it very hard to live with the fact that a member of my own medical profession could be pursuing ethnic cleansing. He's a flamboyant character, terribly good in a way at public relations. I mean, if you'd be asked, why are you bombing Sarajevo? He'd say, we're not bombing Sarajevo, we're just protecting our homes. It's the Muslims who are bombing Sarajevo. There's not very much you can do with a person who just lie flat like that. But he was quite intelligent. He spoke reasonably good English. As I say, in the early part of the war, I think that he did intercede to stop some of the ethnic cleansing and was conscious of the fact that this was certainly viewed by the world as unacceptable. But he grew more and more brutal. And take the business of hostage-taking. In the early days, when you'd argue this with Karadzic, he'd always say, look, these people are being held because they've committed offences. We are bound by the rule of law. I can't discharge these people. They've got to be tried. And there would be at least a pretense that they're committed crimes against as his so-called state. But as the years went by, they took hostages in a way that was perfectly clear that they were being held as part of the argument. I mean, it was terrorism. And there was no attempt to pretend that they had really made crimes. They were just being taken to be used as a bargaining counter. Pretty callous stuff.
Now, when talking with Karadzic, would you try to be neutral in your relations with him, or would there always be this sense hanging over your talks of how morally wrong you thought he was?
Well, I do believe that it's very important for a negotiator to always be polite and to civil, and I think that is absolutely essential.
Even if the other person is responsible for savagery.
Yes, I think I really believe that is a part of the civility of the process. That does not mean that what you say cannot be very tough indeed, but you call them by their names. In the case of Karadzic, since he was not a recognized government, we never called him Mr. President. We always called him Dr. Karadzic. But President Izetbegovic was the ruler of a government, recognized government. He was always President Izetbegovic. Mr. Boban, the Croatian Serb leader, was always Mr. Boban, or Mr. Mikulic, or that sort of thing. But we would treat them properly, meet them at the door, conduct them to their seats. And on very rare occasions, when I raise my voice, I don't believe in arguing by shouting, but every now and then one would occasionally do so. It was done so exceptional that it shook them, I think. By and large, you would just patiently rebut their arguments, remind them of their conduct. You know, we practically every time a negotiating session would start, we would be said people would refuse to sit around the same table for, of course, many months, but they would only sit down if we would stop the shelling. And so we'd have to go off and get the reports from the UN generals on the ground. Very often found there wasn't any shelling. They'd lied about it. Or if the shelling had taken place, it had now stopped. But until you could get that clarified, sometimes the shelling was going on. And this was always very difficult. And quite rightly, they were not prepared to negotiate.
Would Karadzic ever try to charm you and prove that he was really a nice guy, not a bad guy after all?
Yes, I think there was a charm offensive. I don't think it... sometimes we would eat with them, particularly if we were in Serbia. President Milosevic would usually have food and we would conduct a sensible and decent conversation over lunch or dinner.
Was that hard to do, hard to break bread with the people who were behind ethnic cleansing, or is that just like part of the job of negotiating?
I think that is part of the job of negotiating. I think that there are certain things I never did. I never really talked about medicine to Karadzic. That was a bridge too far. He's also interested in poetry, and I'm very interested in poetry. I never talked about poetry with him. It was formally correct, my relationship with him. And to some extent, with all the parties, actually. I don't think one wanted to get on particularly intimate terms with any of them. Some of them were more... Sometimes you would use humour and joke and laugh and change the subject. And you know, that was certainly part of getting people to relax and getting them to think in a fresh and different way. But overall, there was not much humour, not much jokes. Mainly it was hard, drudging, endless talk, endless persuasion, endless pressure, all the time with very little pressure oneself.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Lord David Owen, and he's written a memoir about his attempts to negotiate a peace plan, the Vance Owen peace plan, in the former Yugoslavia. His memoir is called Balkan Odyssey. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Lord David Owen. He's written a new memoir called Balkan Odyssey. Would you share your impressions of President Izetbegovic, the president of the Bosnian Muslim government?
I always liked him. He's a deceptive man. He's small, but he's got very strong, powerful hands. Spent quite a long time in Tito's prisons, and he's the only leader that was never a communist. I think he is a devout Muslim. That isn't to say he's a fundamentalist. It's very hard to tell how much he is influenced by some of the very religious people that are certainly close to him. But he's a thoughtful man, courageous man, actually. It's a hell of a task he had to retain the sort of integrity of his country. And he conducted himself with sort of a degree of dignity and honour. I have a lot of time for him. I pushed him to make compromises. I'm not ashamed of that. I pushed him to try and get a settlement earlier. I could understand why he would resist. And this is why it was so difficult when strong governments like the United States were holding out the possibility of further action when you knew they weren't going to deliver. He was pretty tough. I remember once saying to him, why don't you let the women and children get out of Sarajevo? Because remember, the people who were held in Sarajevo under a double ring, the Serbs, were actually quite happy for the non-fighting people to leave Sarajevo. He said, you would never have let these people out of London in the Blitz. I said, actually, Churchill spent his time trying to get children out into Canada and Commonwealth countries. He was quite surprised when I told him that. But he was a decent man, trying his best in very, very difficult circumstances. But he's also tough and manipulative and, you know, he would hold his corner and he would... He had his own agenda, which he would hold to. He wasn't always truthful either.
And would you share your impressions of President Tudjman of Croatia?
Well, he's the victor. He is tough, opportunistic. He never accepted the Serb presence on any hectare of Croatia. And although there were ceasefire agreements, he ignored them whenever he wanted to. If he felt he could gain some ground by his army attacking, he'd attack. And he'd justify it on the basis they shouldn't have been there in the first place. So he was a difficult character to deal with in many respects. It was sort of, he was so naked about it. There was some quite engaging quality about him. But he is a nationalist, and he does want an ethnically pure Croatia. In that sense, he's rather different from Milosevic. He's got a fairly short fuse. I think he's a Catholic, and I think he will accept that now there must be a deeper democracy in Croatia and that they must head towards European Union membership.
You write in your memoir a bit about some of the duplicities of the war, and you use as an illustration, actually I'd like you to tell this example, about a conversation between a Muslim commander and his Serb counterpart that was picked up by intercept radios about bargaining over the price of Serb shells. Would you tell that story?
It's an amazing story. This was the time when the Croat-Muslim War was running, which ran between 1993 and 1994. And a Muslim commander rings up a Serb commander, who they'd been probably, you know, friends and served together in the Yugoslav army, the JNA. And he said, we've run out of shells. Can we buy some shells from you? And so they negotiated a price for shells in Deutschmarks, and they discussed how lorries could get through the front lines, which the Muslims were going to fire on the Croats. And then there was a gap, and then the phone rang again, this is the field phone, and Muslim commander said, look, we've been thinking about this. How much extra would it cost if we give you the map references of where the Croat forces are for you to fire them rather than have to put them on a lorry and take them to us and then put them in our, fire them from our land? So they negotiated a price, and the Serbs calmly dropped these shells down on the Croat positions, having been paid in Deutschmarks by the Muslims. Now, that story, we actually challenged Karadzic about in front of Milosevic, and Karadzic admitted it had taken place. Milosevic was extremely angry that it had happened, you know, this degree of fraternization. And Karadzic said it wouldn't happen again. But it shows the extraordinary way in which this war goes on. There were strange alliances at all times. Arms were even crossing across the confrontation line on the black market. Everything was sold on the black market.
Lord David Owen has written a new memoir called Balkan Odyssey. He'll be back with us in the second half of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Celebrating 25 years of radio excellence, this is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with Lord David Owen, who spent 3 years trying to negotiate a peace agreement in the former Yugoslavia. We'll talk about some of the absurdities of the war and get his reaction to the Dayton peace plan. Also, Myla Miles reviews some meditative music by Mo Boma. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with the second part of our interview with Lord David Owen. He spent 3 years trying to negotiate a peace settlement in the former Yugoslavia. Owen was the co-chair of the steering committee of the International Conference on the Former Yugoslavia. The peace plan he drew up with Cyrus Vance was never adopted. Shortly after Lord Owen stepped down from his position, a peace plan was brokered by Americans. Lord Owen has written a new memoir called Balkan Odyssey. When we left off, he had told us a story that illustrated the absurdities of the war. I asked him if he witnessed the war's atrocities.
By the nature of it, we didn't see some of the barbarities ourselves, but you heard about them. And I remember we were in Zagreb, and a young Australian UNHCR worker, not that young, a quite experienced man, described how the day before, and we'd been in Banja Luka and everybody had been telling us this hadn't happened and there was no ethnic cleansing, buses had come from Prijedor to the confrontation line and out had shipped the Bosnian Muslims, some with suitcases, some with haversacks, some with just baggage thrown over their shoulder, old, young kids, middle-aged people, all their possessions. And they had to go across nearly a two-mile confrontation line to the waiting UNHCR workers across this plateau. And as they went, he noticed that they were stumbling, and he couldn't understand this. And then he realized that there were rifle shots, and the Serbs were shooting at these Bosnian Muslims as they traversed the no-man's land. And then there was an explosion, and he thought that they'd stepped on a landmine. And then he realized that as they went out of range of the rifles, the Serbs opened up with mortars, and these shells were exploding on these people. And he said to us that he just stood there and then suddenly realized that his face was wet with tears and that he was just crying, grown man. And I tell you, in that room in Zagreb, as he told that story, Vance, myself, UN commanders, tough, strong men, tears started to come down pretty well, I think, everybody's face, and everybody felt that they'd heard a horrible incident. If you have too many of those in your life, it's pretty hard. And, you know, the feeling of impotence, you can't do anything about it. Why can't the world understand this war has got to be brought to an end?
The war was filled with moral dilemmas. For example, during ethnic cleansing, the UN had to face the question of if it helped evacuate Muslims, was it saving lives or was it also helping along the process of ethnic cleansing? Was the UN becoming a partner in ethnic cleansing? How did you deal with that moral dilemma?
I remember that faced us the first day that we started work in Geneva in September, and the UN and the ICRC asked us to use UN troops in Croatia, which didn't have a mandate then in Bosnia, to go into the Bosnian camps and escort these prisoners out of Bosnia into Croatia. So we were effectively conniving in ethnic cleansing. So you ask yourself, what is the greater good? What is the greater evil? And after a sharp tussle, Cy Vance and I agreed that it was right to do this and that the most important thing was to save people's lives and that theoretical arguments were not as important as saving lives. And we faced that dilemma, and workers face that dilemma many, many times. Now, I hope your listeners have heard enough about the complexities of this war to realize that we can't treat this as simplistic stuff. We can't have this savaging and running down of the United Nations. 225, I think it is, UN soldiers lost their lives in the wars of the former Yugoslavia. It's very important that their widows and their sons or daughters, if they had them, don't feel their lives were sacrificed in vain. And I believe they were not. They kept alive many people by keeping those convoys going through and negotiating in Serb roadblocks. Oh, yes, they were humiliated, but they were humiliated on our behalf. And we weren't prepared to let them go in and fight because we never prepared to give the large enough force. It's arguable, anyhow, the UN can go in and fight. They had to be impartial. They had to try and get the greatest good in humane terms. No, the UN's not beyond criticism, but, you know, come on, the United States created the United Nations after the Second World War. It was President Truman and Democrats and Republican senators and congressmen that made it possible. And now I hear voices of politicians denigrating, scapegoating the United Nations in a quite disgraceful way. And I'm out of politics. I've got nothing. I'm not going to take any other international jobs. I'm a private citizen now. But it tears me apart to hear the United Nations made the scapegoat, and what might be a hope for the world destroyed by the cheap rhetoric of politicians.
My impression is that during the war there were many people in Sarajevo who were so frustrated and even disgusted with the peace talks that they started to get angry with the Vance Owen plan, with the people behind it, feeling in a way that it was prolonging the war and that it certainly wasn't ending the war. How did you feel putting so much time and effort into the plan, knowing that some of the people who you were trying to save were actually angry with you?
Well, I think that's perfectly understandable. I mean, I suspect if I'd been in their place, I too would have been angry with them. And they hoped that we could bring the Western military force and power behind them. And there were occasions when I believed that we should have used airstrikes and we should have imposed a settlement. And I argued with my own bosses, the European Union members, and I argued the case publicly. I don't think you can apply force in a vacuum. It was no use just applying force to help the Bosnian Muslims. That wouldn't have helped them. What you had to do was to apply force on a specific peace plan if any of the parties were holding it up. And in the case of the Vance Owen peace plan, the Bosnian Muslims and the Bosnian Croats accepted it was the Bosnian Serbs. And you even got Serbia and Milosevic supporting it. And again with the contact group plan. Now, I remember once Warren Christopher, your Secretary of State, said in a statement in February 1993, we will not impose a peace plan. Well, firstly, I think it was wrong to say that, even if you were not going to. It's better not to let people know you're not going to impose it. Actually, I think it was wrong in principle. And Henry Kissinger, a former Secretary of State, said very soon after that, if we refuse to impose a plan, there will not be a just settlement. Now, this is a vexed question, the loss of life of people in the UN, the so-called body bag syndrome. Over the weekend, the British lost three people in NATO on a landmine.
Mm-hmm.
I think the British public accept that they are there for a good purpose. They have been proud of their troops, trying to get convoys through and feeding them ever since they went in the autumn of 1992. They know it's not easy task, and they know it's a difficult, humiliating task, particularly when it was a UN force and an inadequate force. But I didn't hear demands for them to be removed because of the loss of life. And I think we've got to harden our hearts and realize that peacekeeping, perhaps particularly aggressive peacekeeping, will lead to some loss of life. But the world we're living in now, our armed forces may well have to be more often deployed in the role of peacemakers and peacekeepers than in a straight confrontational war like repulsing the aggression of Kuwait by the Iraqis.
Lord David Owen is my guest, and he's written a memoir about his attempts to negotiate a peace plan in the former Yugoslavia. His memoir is called Balkan Odyssey. Let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Lord David Owen, and he's written a new memoir about trying to negotiate the Vance Owen peace plan. His memoir is called Balkan Odyssey. Do you think it's possible to negotiate a peace when the warring parties aren't ready to stop fighting?
Good question. And that may be the real truth, that until they're exhausted, until these terrible acts had taken place, until they had looked not just over the precipice, but more or less fallen down it, that they were not going to pull back into some degree of sanity and accept a settlement. There was an extraordinary death wish about actually some of the negotiators, some of the politicians. I mean, they didn't understand the virtue of compromise. But I think it's a very disappointing and depressing conclusion. I don't altogether agree with it, and that's what comes clear in this book. I actually do think there were opportunities for the West to impose a settlement a lot earlier, which would have been a lot better. And I think it's important that we do look back, not in the sense of finger-pointing, there'd been much too much scapegoating anyhow, but in an attempt to learn where we all made mistakes.
Do you think that the Bosnian government should have been more willing to compromise earlier on in order to end the war?
Yes, but I understand why they weren't, and I don't think we can expect those people to have taken the full brunt. And this was where the problem lay for the American leaders. It was, in my judgment, the moral case for them to persuade the Bosnian Muslims to make that compromise and not to encourage them to continue the war. The French, the British, and most part the Germans were ready to go to those governments and President Izetbegovic and say, look, I know it's unpleasant, I know it's unpalatable, but it's better to compromise now and end the war. But we couldn't persuade the Americans to do this, and rather contrary, they were actually almost encouraging them to hang on in. Well, hang on in if there's really a better prospect of a better solution. But, we weren't ready to come in and help them. We weren't ready to impose a settlement.
How close would you say the Dayton peace plan is to your plan?
It's pretty different from the Vance Owen peace plan. That was tabled in January 1993, and in my judgment could and should have been implemented in May of 1993. But, in the over 2 years that elapsed, ethnic cleansing went on, and with it came ethnic partition. And so by the time Richard Holbrooke in Dayton was having to get an agreement, it was a very changed situation. Deterioration, and inevitably, the Dayton Agreement is not, in my view, as satisfactory for the Bosnian Muslims as the Vance Owen peace plan would have been. Take a few facts. The Serbs were only given 43% under the Vance Owen peace plan, whereas they got 49% in Dayton. The Vance Owen peace plan had three provinces which were not contiguous, whereas the Serbs got a Republika Srpska Dayton, which they'd long wanted, and contiguous territory, and with a lot of features of a state within a state, which we had deliberately excluded in the Vance Owen peace plan. We were stitching Bosnia-Herzegovina together. This inevitably is a semi-partition. Also, we were demilitarizing the country and effectively disarming all three forces. In Dayton, we've got three forces continuing in positions of considerable strength. So all in all, I'm afraid I think it's a settlement inevitably by dint of the continuation of the war that offers much less chance of reversing ethnic cleansing, and I'm afraid ethnic partition shows every sign of remaining. I won't say we won't be able to get some reversal, I think we will, but it will be very minimal.
Why do you think that the Dayton plan was agreed on when the Vance Owen peace plan was never agreed on and implemented?
Well, one of the major reasons is the United States was fully committed and part of the negotiations. And they never, unfortunately, the Clinton administration, felt committed to the Vance Owen peace plan. Indeed, some of their spokesmen made life extremely difficult by pointing out, which was false at the time, that the Vance Owen peace plan acquiesced in ethnic cleansing and in territorial aggrandizement. In the light of what has happened, those charges are plainly ludicrous. I don't want to just look back, let's look forward. I mean, I don't want these remarks to be interpreted as being critical of Dayton Agreement and what Richard Holbrooke achieved, which I always think was considerable. Also, I do welcome the change of policy that came in August 1995 when President Clinton sent his security advisor, Tony Lake, to Europe, and the Europeans welcomed it. But I'm afraid it is a fact of life that there were serious disagreements before, and on many key features within the contact group, like accepting Republika Srpska, accepting the need to talk to Milosevic, accepting the need to have a constitution as well as a map, accepting that the map would have to be revised. The Americans came along with and accepted the position of the Europeans.
Let me ask you, did you feel at all jealous when Richard Holbrooke succeeded in getting agreement to his peace plan?
No, genuinely not. I mean, I was out anyhow by then. I left before the change in policy in the U.S. occurred. I wrote to President Mitterrand, as it was in January 1995, at the start of the French presidency, and I said, you know, I really put my office at your disposal. I'll go at any time that's convenient, but I must go by June and the end of the French presidency. And then when President Chirac came in May, I wrote to him and said I had to go. I'd been really devoted 3 years to this, nearly 3 years. And I'd said initially when I was approached to do it, and Cy Vance asked me if I would, we thought it would take 6 months. So it was time for me to go, and it was time for me to become a private citizen, as I'd planned to do when I left the House of Commons. Also, in a strange way, I'd already been through this business of finding you lay foundations on which other people build. That's inevitably part of international diplomacy. I'd worked for long and hard on trying to get a resolution of the conflict in Rhodesia, and then the election had come in 79, and Mrs. Thatcher came in, rather similar situation, having adopted in opposition a critical attitude to the negotiations and even the idea of talking to Mugabe, and then had to change and adapt, and did so rather well. And Peter Carrington, who came in as Foreign Secretary, succeeded in getting a deal for an independent Zimbabwe, and I was delighted. And, you know, that's life. You don't, in politics, particularly in international politics, always see a return on your work. And there's, fortunately, a good deal of bipartisan support across governments, in our case, Labour Conservative, in your case, Democrat Republican.
Do you think that the Dayton peace plan is going to be the basis of a lasting peace? I'm wondering if you think that the peace plan is almost too complicated to really work.
No, I don't think it's terribly complicated. I mean, it is bluntly a partition, and partitions in that sense have a merit of simplicity. And by and large, Republika Srpska can get on in their own life, and they have, if you like, acquiesced, as have the Croats, in us calling Bosnia-Herzegovina a single country. But they know that the Croats will relate to Croatia and will, in effect, contribute to a greater Croatia, and the Serbs will relate to Serbia in relating to a bigger, not the greater Serbia of their dreams of the Serbs, but still a larger Serbia. The big victors in these wars, could argue there have been four wars since 1991, is Croatia and President Tudjman. I'm not saying he deserves to win, but he's the person who comes out on top. And, you know, we saw in July and August of 1995 the worst ethnic cleansing of the whole wars. 50,000 Muslims forced out by Bosnian Serbs from Zepar and Srebrenica. And then 200,000 Serbs forced out from Croatia by the Croatian army. It was a pretty miserable end. But these were the geopolitical changes, if you like, which made it more easy to get a settlement. Also, of course, by then, the UN were out of all the enclaves, out of the dangerous areas, out of the points where they were exposed to the Bosnian Serb army. So it was possible to bomb at the end of August and early September and effectively impose a settlement, something I'd argued for, bombing to impose the Vance-Owen peace plan in May 1993 and the contact group plan in the summer of 1994.
We just have a little bit of time left. I'm wondering what you think the lessons are in the experiences of the peace process in the former Yugoslavia.
I think the main lesson is that you must not have this mismatch between, in the Security Council resolutions passed by the 15 members of the Council, between rhetoric and resources. And one of the recommendations in the final chapter of the book is that in future the Security Council membership should carry a commitment to provide troops to UN activity so that the countries that make the decisions to send the UN anywhere know that it's their own people they're sending, their own troops, their own defense ministers involved, their prime minister or presidents involved. I think Security Council, where the majority of countries voting and making decisions are actually not sending their own troops, leads to a slight disconnect. And I know in government, when you decide to send your troops, it must have been an agonizing choice for President Clinton to decide to send troops now to implement the Dayton Peace Corps. And I remember in British government, sending troops is a very tough decision taken by a cabinet, hardest decision they take. That same attention to protecting the lives of their people needs to come into the debates in the Security Council.
Lord Owen, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Lord David Owen has written a new memoir called Balkan Odyssey. This is Fresh Air. Music critic Milo Miles has some contemplative music he wants to recommend. It belongs in the eclectic, international, easy listening category, usually not one of Milo's favorites.
Some people call it meditative music, though I always thought the only proper accompaniment for meditation was silence. Some people call it late night or early morning music, but often those are folks who only listen to music at those times of day. Some people even call it new age music, though not when I'm around. Anyway, most of it is so languid and mush-minded as to be unspeakable. But every once in a while, nicely rounded and rigorous examples come along. One is a Northern European duo who call themselves Moboma. Another is a trio with the unlikely lineup of David Rothenberg on clarinet, Graham Boone on banjo, and Glenn Velez on frame drum. Here's a sample of Moboma from their album Myths of the Near Future, Part 1. Moboma are essentially a bass and guitar outfit with a lot of attachments. Bassist Skúli Sverrisson is the more flexible and inventive soloist, and he is probably responsible for nourishing the wide variety of low tones and drones on Moboma's three albums. Guitar, percussion, keyboards, and samples are handled by Carsten Tiedemann. He indulges in the occasional massive synthesizer swoosh, but makes up for it with some spiky guitar punctuation in the arrangements. There's a dewy tone to Moboma's presentation, titles like The Garden of Time, and dedication to all the world's extinct plants, animals, and indigenous people. But a sign of Moboma's taste and restraint is that they sample, as they put it, Central African voice, bird, forest sounds, and I don't hate it. Moboma are particularly recommended to fans of the more reflective ECM albums. The Rothenberg Boone Velez trio, on the other hand, should appeal to those who treasure early period albums by the group Oregon. Thank you. Rothenberg Boone Velez CD is called On the Cliffs of the Heart, and one sign of the ever-present danger of sentimentality is that even though that's a line from Rilke, it sounds squishy out of context. The trio take on folk themes from France, Scotland, Turkey, and elsewhere, with the French being the most incisive, surprisingly. There's also blather in the liner notes about home being where you find it in music. But aside from sheer virtuosity and smart interplay, the reason On the Cliffs of the Heart works is because the predominant clarinet, banjo, and frame drum are tartar and tougher sounding than the more usual flute, guitar, trap drum setup. You can get away with more saccharine sound on harsher instruments. Too bad more people don't have the chops to try it.
Milo Miles is a music writer living in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Here's a tribute to the late jazz trumpeter Don Cherry from the Rothenberg Boone Velez album, Cliffs of the Heart. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Roberta Shurrock, with Kathy Wolf. Alan Tu directed today's show. We want to welcome the listeners of KUT in Austin, Texas, which started broadcasting Fresh Air today. We'll close the show with music by Austin-based singer-songwriter Jimmy Dale Gilmore. I'm Terry Gross.
You found me when my heart was broken and the cold world was closing in. And with a word unspoken, you taught me how to live and love and laugh again. You found me when my wings were broken and I was crying. And with your word unspoken, you made me whole and showed me how to fly.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we go back into the archives for some memorable interviews from the past. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next archive edition of Fresh Air.